Hello, this is Wendy Kriegels. Welcome. I would like to welcome you to the monthly podcast of the Vestibular Special Interest Group of the Neurology Section of the American Physical Therapy Association. Our topic today is pharmacology in vestibular disorders. I will be your hostess. I am Wendy Kriegels. I am a physical therapist and a neurologic clinical specialist, and I'm on faculty at the University of Colorado, Denver. And we have with us today Dr. Timothy Hain from Chicago. And Dr. Hain, you can give your introduction.
Hi, Wendy. I'm a neurologist, and I'm a professor of otolaryngology and physical therapy at Northwestern University here in Chicago. I spend most of my time in private practice at a practice called Chicago Disease and Hearing, and mainly see dizzy patients and some patients with hearing disorders. When I tell patients what I do, I say I'm a dizzy doctor. And so I think that kind of sums it all up.
That's great. Well, thank you for joining us today. We're very honored that you will give us some of your expertise today. So today's format will be some question and answers. We're going to start with a question regarding some of the different otologic causes of vertigo. We'll start with one of the most common disorders that we treat, BPPV. So, Dr. Hain, do you feel it's appropriate to treat individuals with BPPV with meclizine or another vestibular suppressant?
Well, sort of the short answer is sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And the, as you said, BPPV is very common, and in my own practice, I see a new patient at least once a day, sometimes three or four a day. And usually, the best treatment for BPPV is physical therapy. And so if you can treat them right on the spot, or if you can arrange for them to have the appropriate maneuver, that's by far the best way to manage them. Mm-hmm. There are sometimes situations, though, when meclizine comes in pretty handy. And one is when the person is unwilling to treat themselves or to do the self-epley, for example, or they're unwilling to come in for their therapy visits because they're afraid it will make them so dizzy. And so you might give them meclizine a half an hour prior to their attempted treatment. And another time is when people just have trouble sleeping, and when they roll over in bed at night and then they get dizzy, and then they start to be sleepless because they're so dizzy. And so I will sometimes have them take meclizine for a few weeks while they're in the process of getting physical therapy for their BPPV.
Mm-hmm. And some of the individuals certainly that come to physical therapy and perhaps in your practice as well, actually have acute onset of dizziness. They go to the emergency department, and they are given meclizine, and they're sent kind of on their merry way for a while with that suppressant. What are the potential risks of being on that vestibular suppressant for a long period of time when it is something as simple as BPPV?
Well, there's quite a few reasons not to do that. One is that these medicines have quite significant side effects, and of which sedation is the most important one with meclizine. And so a patient who goes to the emergency room, they have BPPV, and they're sent home with, say, meclizine 25 milligrams twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
They're tired from the meclizine, and they might have a dry mouth and dry eyes from the anticholinergic effects of the meclizine, and they're sleeping, and they're gaining weight from the
mm-hmm.
antihistamine part of the meclizine, but they're not doing anything about their core condition, which is the BPPV.
Mm-hmm.
And so in someone like that, I would usually take them right off their meclizine and say, you need to have exercises, not be taking this medicine. And so that kind of patient, I would usually take them off their meclizine. Another group of patients might be someone who goes to the emergency room. They have vestibular neuritis and BPPV at the same time. And those people, the meclizine can be useful for a few days. And so it makes them a little more comfortable. They're not going back to work anyway, so it's okay if they're sleeping all day long. And at least they're not vomiting. And
mm-hmm.
so it gives them some time for their their acute vestibular neuritis to resolve, and then after two or three days, then you take them off and you proceed on with plan A, which is to treat them with physical therapy or give them time to recover and be active and not sedate them.
Mm-hmm.
The meclizine, of course, is just one of several emergency room vestibular suppressants.
Right.
And I'd say the other one that that people often come home with, at least in Chicago, is on Valium or some Valium-like medicine, such as lorazepam.
Right.
And those medicines, I think, are best. They don't have quite as many side effects as meclizine, but they're addictive. And so I'll usually wag my finger at the patient and say, well, you realize this is an addictive medication and it's not good for you to be on this, and I really think you should try to get off it as soon as you can. The medicine that I'm perfectly happy with the emergency room to send them home with is an anti-nausea medicine such as ondansetron, because the ondansetron, or used to be, the brand name is Zofran, ondansetron is just doesn't seem to have much in the way of side effects, and by making them less nauseated, it allows them to patients to be more active and sometimes make more progress towards getting back to their life again.
Hmm. And with meclizine, you mentioned you would take the individual right off the meclizine. With the drugs such as Valium or lorazepam, do you need to be more careful about weaning an individual from those, or is it okay to go sort of cold turkey with those medications if they came to you right from an emergency room and maybe weren't optimally treated?
Well, it depends very much on how long they've been on their medication. With meclizine, you can usually just cold turkey, and there's really no major problem at all. With the benzodiazepine family, such as Valium, diazepam itself, or clonazepam, clonopin, or lorazepam, Ativan, once people have been on those medicines for about a week, they may start to have some trouble with withdrawal if you were to stop them suddenly. And so usually as sort of a rule of thumb, I'll bring them off slowly, and I'll have them cut down their dose in half every week until they're down to almost nothing. In order to sort of explain to patients about how much of these drugs are they taking in terms of garden variety substances that people use, I use what I call the beer scale, and so I'll say, well, one beer, or I guess a glass of Chardonnay if you prefer, is equivalent to about a half milligram of either lorazepam or clonazepam, and it's equivalent to about 2 milligrams of Valium. And so when someone comes home on 2 milligrams of Valium or 5 broken up into 2.5 doses, then I'll say, well, that's about like drinking 2 beers a day, and that's going to make you kind of groggy, and I think you should kind of cut down slowly.
Mm-hmm.
If someone gets sent home from the emergency room on 10 milligrams of Valium, then I say, oh, my, that's a lot of Valium.
Mm-hmm.
You need to get off that in a hurry because it's going to make you into a very different person.
Mm-hmm. You brought up just briefly in that question vestibular neuritis, and can you just give us a brief overview of the difference between vestibular neuritis and labyrinthitis and how the treatments for those are different?
Well, so vestibularitis and labyrinthitis both share a subacute dizziness. By that I mean that the dizziness lasts for typically for weeks. It's not minutes such as it is in BPPV or TIAs or years like it is in ototoxicity, but rather it's a typical duration of symptoms severe enough to keep one from working with either vestibular neuritis or labyrinthitis is about 2 weeks. And so people often just develop severe dizziness over 2 or 3 hours in both cases. And the only real difference between labyrinthitis and vestibular neuritis has to do with whether they have any hearing complaints or not. And it's purely just a term that's used. And so if they have tinnitus or hearing loss plus the dizziness, then then the label applied is labyrinthitis. And if they have just a pure dizziness without any hearing symptoms at all, then the quote-unquote diagnosis is vestibular neuritis.
Mm-hmm.
Probably in both cases we're dealing with the same underlying disorder, which right now the prevalent opinion is that we're dealing with a viral inflammation of the eighth nerve. In a vestibular neuritis, it's purely the vestibular part, and in labyrinthitis, it's the cochleal vestibular nerve, or a bigger portion of the nerve.
Mm-hmm.
They're treated these days. The current treatment is the change in the treatment has been to add steroids to the regime, and so now people are treated with for vestibular neuritis in a similar way that Bell's palsy is treated with a short course of steroids and then medicines to take care of their symptoms, such as meclizine or ondansetron for nausea and to suppress some of the spinning.
Mm-hmm. And so is there ever an indication for antibiotics, or is it mostly felt that this is a viral trigger and that it's relatively rare to have a bacterial trigger?
The only situation in which I think you would ever use antibiotics would be as if there was good evidence for a middle ear infection.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, if one had a perforation in the eardrum or a draining ear or a very painful ear, then one might give the person antibiotics with the thought that they might have an infection in the middle ear and some impingement on the inner ear due to transmission of inflammatory mediators across the round window into the inner ear. That is a much less common scenario than this, at least in adults, just the occurrence of someone who doesn't have any ear pain but rather has a painless vertigo, sometimes accompanied by a hearing loss.
Right. Okay. And let's talk about Meniere's disease for a minute, or even the larger family of endolymphatic high drops. What is the current thinking behind the treatment for both acute episodes and for sort of ongoing management?
Well, Meniere's is a uncommon condition. About 1 in 2,000 people in the population, according to the Mayo Clinic study, have Meniere's disease. And it's characterized by 4 cardinal symptoms: episodic vertigo, hearing loss, one ear fullness, monaural fullness, and monaural tinnitus. And so, sort of the typical patient with Meniere's is someone who has a hissing type tinnitus, and then they develop a plugged feeling in one ear, and then a day or two later, they develop a sudden onset of vertigo and a drop in their hearing. And they have the vertigo lasts, it's most severe for about 2 hours, but they still feel out of sorts usually for about a couple of days, and then they're ready to go back to their usual activities after about 2 days. So the central dogma concerning Meniere's, which is a little bit under attack, is that Meniere's disease is caused by too high pressure in the endolymphatic compartment of the inner ear. And so it's caused by endolymphatic high drops. As I said, this is a little bit under attack, and there's lots of reasons you could bring up to say, well, that doesn't really make that much sense, but still, it's the best explanation.
Mm-hmm.
That we have. And so the treatment is fairly unsatisfactory, and so we have this group of people who are sort of out of the blue developing dizzy spells, and they're gradually going deaf in one ear, and over 30 years, nearly always that ear will become unusable. That's a very long time, of course, but they gradually lose hearing in one ear, and half the time it spreads to the other ear. So we have this group of people with this sort of chronic inner ear disease, which never really goes away, and our medical management is pretty bad. And usually, conventionally, people are started on salt restriction. And so the usual dietary suggestion is less than 2 grams of sodium per day, and if you can, get down to 1.5 grams of sodium per day. So that's not very much sodium.
Mm-hmm.
And there are perhaps 1 out of 3 patients with Meniere's disease who will say, well, this really is great, and as long as I keep up with this, I'm fine. And so 1 out of 3, roughly, you get picked off with this salt restriction. For the people who either the salt restriction doesn't work or the or they just won't salt restrict, then the next step is usually a diuretic. And the sort of the industry standard diuretic in the United States is one called Diazide is the brand name, or Triamterene HCTZ.
Mm-hmm.
So Triamterene is a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor type diuretic, and HCTZ is a thiazide. And one of them increases potassium, and the other one decreases potassium. So you put the two together, and you end up with one that's kind of potassium neutral. So this is a favored prescription because you don't have to give them two things. You just have to give them one pill, which is this Triamterene HCTZ. And so for the people who fail the salt restriction, then you move on to the Triamterene HCTZ. And I'd say, again, about the same third of the population who does well on the salt restriction does well on the diuretic.
Mm-hmm.
Right now I'm just talking about prevention.
Right,
preventative,
right.
Methods. And then the next, so I'd say that's the initial treatment, and almost everyone will agree on that there should be salt restriction and maybe restrict a lot of other things too, but at least salt. And
mm-hmm.
And then... if that doesn't work, then to switch over to the diuretic. Then sort of in the middle treatment, which is the, I'd say is fairly controversial, is a whole array of drugs and nostrums and substances. Probably they don't work, or probably if they work, they don't work very well. And so in the United States, we don't really have much of a middle group of medicines. But the Europeans are fond of medicines in the middle, and they have a medicine called beta-histine or CERC, and then they have another one called flunarizine. And so the beta-histine is a sort of a puzzling medicine that's a doesn't seem to do very much, but about a third of patients with Meniere's disease will say that they get a substantial benefit from beta-histine. It's a its pharmacology is that it's a histamine agonist, so it's the opposite of an antihistamine. It actually increases histamine. And why that would make Meniere's better, I don't know. But but nevertheless, if you take a large group of patients with Meniere's, about a third of them seem to get some benefit from the beta-histine. And I have many patients who say, oh, you saved my life, Dr. Hain. You put me on this beta-histine, and now I'm fine.
Hmm.
So I don't know if that's really the case or not, but
mm-hmm.
I'm happy that they're fine.
Right.
And the other group of medicines that are used in the middle are also ones that work as migraine prevention medicines. And so, for example, calcium channel blockers. In the Europe, there's one called flunarizine. And in this country, the closest one to flunarizine is verapamil, which is an L-channel, calcium channel blocker. And because there's a very substantial overlap between migraine and Meniere's disease, one finds as a clinician that the same things that are treatments that are used for migraine are somewhat helpful for Meniere's. And verapamil is the one that I am quite fond of. And again, they've already failed the salt restriction, then my next step will be to try this beta-histine verapamil combination. And I'd say I'd pick off out of the people left over after the first third did well with the salt restriction, I'll get about another third with the beta-histine and the verapamil.
Hmm.
So that will leave me with just a third left over at the end of people who didn't respond to any medical management. And things have gotten so much better recently because of the low-dose gentamicin treatment. And the injection of gentamicin through the eardrum, usually just a single injection, is 85% effective at stopping the vertigo spells in Meniere's disease. So after they've passed through these two sieves, you know, the salt restriction, which is kind of tough, and then medical management, which takes a few months, if they're still have disabling attacks of vertigo, then nearly always you can stop them from having these vertigo spells with a low-dose gentamicin treatment, which is one injection and 85% stops the vertigo.
And then is that typical of, are you actually ablating the labyrinth so they will lose any remaining hearing that they have, or is it, or may they keep, you say 85% effective, is it possible there's some function still remaining that's beneficial?
Yes, this is this treatment has been evolving over the last four decades, and sort of what everyone has learned is that less is more. And so the original idea was that the gentamicin treatment, which is of course a toxic drug to the inner ear, was going to just a way of doing surgery without cutting people, and so that you could totally eliminate inner ear function without ever having to cut their skin. And it was just seen as a knifeless surgery. But what I'll skip over an immense amount of interesting stuff in the middle. All sorts of mistakes were made. About 15 years ago, Dr. Driscoll at the Mayo Clinic, before then, we were giving four injections of gentamicin, and really the intent was just to obliterate the inner ear. And then, the method at that point was to give these injections once a week. But at the Mayo Clinic, it doesn't really work that well to give injections once a week because, you know, you're kind of far away from usually where people are living. Mm-hmm. So he was having them come back once a month. And he would have them come back once a month, and they came back after a month, and they weren't dizzy anymore. And then Dr. Driscoll said, well, gee, if they're not dizzy, why am I giving them the second injection? So he just sent them back home again. He did that with about 20 patients and reported that you get excellent results. You can stop the vertigo with one injection instead of four injections. And so instead of obliterating the inner ear, you're just kind of beating it up a little bit. You're knocking it down a little.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, and you know, we've done this many, many times here in our practice in Chicago, and I think you lose about 20% of your vestibular function if you test people before and after. It looks as if they lose about 20% of their vestibular function, and they don't lose any hearing at all.
Mm.
It is not at all a treatment that's toxic to hearing, and so you end up with this sort of wonderful situation where you can stop their vertigo spells and usually permanently, although not always, and with no effect on hearing. So it's really a pretty nice treatment from the perspective of doing little damage. It doesn't
right.
do a lot of damage.
Right. Okay. Well, what I'd like to move on next are more central causes of vertigo. So what might the appropriate medications be for individuals with central disorders? We can go through this one by one. I'll bring up the major ones. You did speak a little bit about migraine already. Stroke, multiple sclerosis, traumatic brain injury are kind of the ones that come to the forefront of my mind as far as a physical therapist perspective. What are your thoughts about appropriate medications for those individuals?
Well, the only place where there's been a lot of improvement recently has been in treatment for migraine.
Mm-hmm.
And so migraine is very important for central vertigo because it's so common. And 10% of the entire population has migraine. And some groups in the population have a lot more migraine, such as women of childbearing age, where it gets up to around 20 to 25%. And because roughly 1 in 3 people with migraine have vertigo, so if we just do the numbers, 10% of the population, a third of them have vertigo, so now we've got 3% of the entire population has central vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
So that way dwarfs any other type of vertigo. It's much more than Meniere's disease. It's much more than any inner ear condition you can imagine. The only thing any, even close to migraine are things that aren't really vertigo, but rather low blood pressure or hypotension, which is a different category altogether.
Mm-hmm.
But so migraine treatment is hugely important because there's so many people with migraine-associated vertigo. And the and things have really gotten much better in the last 10 years. The probably the beginning of the improvement was with the triptan medications. And so all of a sudden we had these medicines that we could give someone in the waiting room, and 10 minutes later their headache and dizziness would be all gone.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a remarkable improvement. And I think most of the improvement in recent years has been having to do with preventative medicines, of which there are three categories. And there's been quite a bit new knowledge about those three categories just in the last 5 years or so. And so the antidepressant category, of which includes the main three are the venlafaxine, which is also known as Effexor, which is a wonderful migraine prevention medicine, and then there are the triptyline medicines, the tricyclics such as amitriptyline and nortriptyline. So what's really happened there is that the amitriptyline and nortriptyline have fallen way down in the hierarchy of which medicine do you want to use because of their side effects. They basically they make people gain weight, and very few women at childbearing age are eager to gain 25 pounds, which is the only thing that happens with these. And what's really been coming up fast is venlafaxine, which is a different type of antidepressant. And amazingly effective, just a low dose of venlafaxine, which is a starting dose, is 80% effective in placebo-controlled double-blind trials for migraine prevention.
Hmm.
So you have this really wonderful situation where a low dose, meaning low side effect medication, is extremely effective.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big change just in the last I think the first paper about this was in 2004, so this is pretty recent in the knowledge, the last 7 years. The second group of migraine prevention medicines are the seizure medicines, of which topiramate and sodium valproate would be probably the most commonly used ones. Those are going down in use right now, mainly because people are appreciating how toxic they are to newborn babies.
Mm.
In other words, the birth defect rates are very frightening with these drugs.
Mm.
And the topiramate, 10% of women on topiramate, their babies are born with cleft palate.
Mm.
So that's quite a frightening situation. So, and because so much migraine is in women of childbearing age, and you're worried that they might have a baby with these drugs on board, they and you've got so much better options. Those have really gone south rather quickly recently.
Mm-hmm.
Then the third group of medicines, I mentioned already, verapamil is a good migraine prevention medicine, and calcium channel blockers and beta blockers. Those medicines have kind of remained about steady, and they're still quite good ones, but for migraine prevention, but they have significant side effects, mainly involving lowering blood pressure. And usually in the population that has migraine-associated vertigo, which are usually women of childbearing age, their blood pressure is already 100 over 60.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
You just don't want to knock it down even more. And so usually they can't really take those medications.
Okay.
Now, so there's been a lot of movement with migraine in the last decade, and even in the last 5 years. There's been very little change in all the other types of central vertigo. For example, if someone has a stroke involving their cerebellum, and you know that they have a big hole in their cerebellum, and you know that's why they're dizzy, you're really pretty hard pressed to come up with a medication that can replace the function of their cerebellum.
Right.
We don't have any medications that cause neurons to grow back. We really don't have any medicines that do much in terms of promoting compensation.
Hmm.
And sort of the general rule, which goes for all types of central vertigo, is that things that put you to sleep reduce compensation, and things that wake you up enhance compensation. So sort of as a general rule, you wouldn't want someone with central vertigo to be on a sedative.
Right.
So you wouldn't want someone with a stroke to be on meclizine, or because that would be putting them to sleep and mm-hmm. making them gain weight. And you'd be kind of unhappy about them taking Valium or clonazepam or lorazepam for their vertigo, although maybe at the end when you tried everything else, you might be stuck with it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The medications you would really like them to be on is as few as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So you really try to encourage them to, you know, if they're on anything that looks like it might be sedating, to cut back on it or try to get by with a version of it that has a shorter time constant so it doesn't last as long in their system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about drugs that kind of have dizziness as a side effect, especially in the elderly population of patients. We have, if you read the Walgreens side effect list on just about any medication, you'll find dizziness as a side effect. What are really the most common red flags or the most common combinations of medications that may cause symptoms of dizziness or true vertigo, probably more dizziness?
Generally, these medicines don't cause vertigo, but rather they
mm-hmm.
they cause unsteadiness,
mm-hmm.
And sometimes a sort of a funny feeling when the people move their head as if things aren't quite catching up
mm-hmm.
with them, and so vertigo would be very rare
mm-hmm.
As a medication side effect. Much more commonly unsteadiness,
mm-hmm.
and so and as you said, the if you look at the PDR, there are 5,000 drugs that are listed as having dizziness as a side effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that if you gave people sugar pills, that half the time, well, not half the time, maybe 5% of people would get dizziness from a sugar pill. And so there's a sort of a baseline that, you know, dizziness is a common human condition, and people frequently seem to endorse that as a something that happens whenever they take a pill.
Hmm.
And so we have this baseline of about 5 to 7% of a placebo-induced dizziness. And then so you really, when you look at medications, then you have to say, well, is it more than 5 to 7%? Is it really a significant source of dizziness? And there are many medicines that are problematic in that regard. The one obvious group are the blood pressure medications.
Mm-hmm.
And because people take blood pressure medicines, their blood pressure drops too low, and then they get faint when they stand up, and so they call and say that they're dizzy. Some of the blood pressure medications are also vasodilators, and so they interact with migraine.
Mm.
So there's a second mechanism for blood pressure medications. Almost everyone gets headaches, for example, from nitroglycerin, which is a nitrate that's a
mm-hmm.
vasodilator. A second group of medications that commonly, and this is all sort of common sense, but the ones that get into your brain are the ones that are more likely to make
mm-hmm.
you
dizzy. Mm-hmm.
Psychiatric type medications are commonly sources of dizziness,
mm-hmm.
and also antidepressants and seizure medications. And so many of the medicines that are just commonly used for depression, although they may not make people seriously ill, they may be associated with this dizziness side effect.
Mm-hmm.
Or people who take medicines such as carbamazepine, which is a seizure medicine, they very frequently become dizzy on carbamazepine. Another commonly prescribed medication are medications that improve prostate function. And so the alpha blockers cause orthostatic hypotension, and they have a frighteningly high incidence of dizziness in the order of around 30%. Medication that really makes me worry when I have a patient come in is when someone is on amiodarone.
Hmm.
Amiodarone is a drug that's used to keep people who have atrial fibrillation from having atrial fibrillation. And it's a very effective cardiac drug, but it just has a long list of central nervous system side effects, and which gradually accumulate over time. And so people are on amiodarone, and initially they feel pretty good. They don't have their atrial fib anymore. But then over time they develop a peripheral neuropathy, and then they start to become unsteady, and and then it's time to get them off their amiodarone.
And then you're kind of alluding to the last topic that I wanted to discuss just real briefly are medications that are used for some other medical condition that are ototoxic. The side effect is ototoxic. So you mentioned gentamicin, you know, being used. It could be used as to treat a life-threatening infection, for instance, chemotherapy agents that have an ototoxic side effect. If you could just give us a couple of quick examples of those most common ototoxic medications and how much they would ever clear the system, or if once they get to a critical dose, they will essentially ablate or disrupt vestibular function, never to recover.
Yes, these are very big problems. So the main group that's the huge problem are the aminoglycoside medications, of which gentamicin and tobramycin are the main problematic members. Gentamicin is the much bigger problem. And so gentamicin is an aminoglycoside, a member of a whole family of medicines that are called aminoglycosides. And all of the aminoglycosides, every single one of them, are ototoxic. And sort of curiously, some of them are mostly hearing toxic, and some of them are mostly vestibulotoxic. So, for example, neomycin is almost a pure hearing toxin. It doesn't do much at all to the vestibular system, but terrible for hearing. But on the other hand, gentamicin is a pure, almost pure vestibulotoxin. So what that means then is that someone who is on gentamicin, who perhaps has a very serious infection, they have a heart valve infection or a bone infection or a very serious kidney infection, they're put on the gentamicin, and it often does a really good job of killing the bacteria because these are quite powerful antibiotics, but it accumulates in the inner ear. And so every day when the gentamicin is given, it comes and goes in the blood very quickly because it has a two-hour half-life. But in the ear, it stays for months. So every time you give more gentamicin, some more sticks to the ear. And so after a couple of weeks, it usually takes at least a week of gentamicin, then there's enough drug that's accumulated in the inner ear that it starts to do damage. And because gentamicin is a pure vestibulotoxin, it starts to do vestibular damage. So here you are, you're lying in bed, you're getting this drug every day that's being injected, and your ear is gradually being pared away by, by the gentamicin. You may not even realize it. And then after a month goes by and the drug is stopped, and then you try to get up and walk around and use your hip or use your heart again, then you realize, boy, I sure am unsteady. I wonder why I'm so unsteady. And what unfortunately happens about 5% of the time is that these people have been on long courses of gentamicin is that their ear has been damaged during the course of antibiotic, and often it's gone down to 10% or 25% of what they normally should have, and that is not enough for them to use their vestibular ocular reflex and see when their head is in motion. So they develop oscillopsia. So gentamicin is the biggest problem, and one that's coming up more recently is tobramycin, which is used for cystic fibrosis. So tobramycin is really almost only confined to the cystic fibrosis population, but the story is very similar, is that people are getting intravenous tobramycin for some terrible infection, and then gradually, because they get multiple courses of this drug over years, they pare away their inner ear function, and sometimes they lose their hearing as a result of these ototoxic medicines. Now, unfortunately, there is no, in humans, there is no regeneration of the inner ear. And so once your hair cells are dead in the ear, and these are hair cell toxins, they're dead forever. And so this is really a situation where the people's lives are saved by the drugs, but their quality of life can be very different because they're unable to balance themselves and they can't see very well when their head is in motion.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. So as far as prognosis, the acutely people are usually quite bad shape after they've had a month course of gentamicin and they've had the ototoxicity. And so they will usually be very, very unsteady, and they won't drive, and they will really have terrible balance and have oscillopsia. And this all gradually improves, but it doesn't ever get back to normal. And so in the first year, usually people have a very substantial recovery. And
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I think we're out of time. I would like to thank you, Dr. Hain, for joining us today for this podcast. It was a pleasure having you. And
thank you.
On behalf of the Vestibular Special Interest Group, I thank our listeners for tuning in today. And I will let you know that next month's topic for January 2012 will be on visual vertigo. So we hope to have you back again. And thank you again, Dr. Hain.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.